Brianna Beersbach is the exceptional political writer for MinnPost, and she is kind enough to join us today to talk about some of her latest stories. Hi, Brianna.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going very well. Oh, well, it's going very well for us. It's not going to go too well for Rod Hamilton currently. I want to start off with that because we talked about that on the show yesterday. And there was – but I actually want to go back to Tuesday's show. On Tuesday's show, if you go back and listen to it, I actually talk about, wow, finally the Minnesota Republicans in the House are taking sexual harassment seriously. They seem to get these rules. They're getting these rules passed. There's this new bill that Pepin and Housley and the Senate are championing about making it easier for women to report sexual harassment and file charges against sexual harassment, sexual assault. You know, wow, okay, finally. I mean, they were dragging their heels for a while, but there we go. And I said – I only hope that while the Republicans were dragging their heels ever since Tony Cornish left the House last year, that there haven't been any other cases of sexual assault, sexual harassment reported. And then we have what came out. I think it was Wednesday night as the story first came on out about Representative Rod Hamilton. That case, it really does at this point, even after 24 hours, it does seem like it's really more of a he said, she said sort of situation. At least that's what Ramsey County seemed to be insisting as far as whether they would be able to press charges.
Yeah, I think the Ramsey County attorney is saying in terms of a criminal case, what is there isn't a criminal charge. You know, she did file the report, the young woman who did, and she said there was no for it to actually go slip into a criminal charge. It would have to have been touching of intimate parts. She said that did not happen, but she was also clear that what happened was not consented by her and made her incredibly uncomfortable, which she did make clear apparently in text messages after the incident to the representative.
And we want to be very clear, allegations. These are allegations, but there does seem to be some decisions that were made by Representative Hamilton, which raise an eyebrow or two, to say the least. And once again, it's allegations. They're not saying there's charges to be filed, but it, you know, whether or not we want to, you know, any comparisons we can put to Schoen or to Cornish last year, there seems to have been some poor judgment, which is not helping his case.
Yeah, there's definitely some things everyone agrees on, including the representative in terms of what happened. I mean, certainly he met this young woman, and he admitted he did invite her to his apartment near the Capitol, you know, because there was a snowstorm. Some of the touching he acknowledges happened, but he said it was in a non-sexual way, according to his statements. She said she felt they were, and she was very uncomfortable. And she said she was also very clear that she's a survivor of sexual assault, that she was clear that touching like that made her uncomfortable since her assault. So there are some things already that are pretty clear and all parties seem to agree on that are inappropriate enough where their House is launching an investigation regardless of whether there are any kind of criminal charges that are going to be filed. So this is going to be something that is looked into. And in terms of parallels to what happened last year with Representative Cornish and former Senator Schoen, you see some similarities. I mean, this young woman was not a staffer at the Capitol. She was someone who interacted with the legislator through, you know, her advocacy or her work or campaigns like so many people do. And that was the same thing with Cornish. You know, his main allegations were coming from a lobbyist, and Schoen's main allegations came from someone on the campaign trail. So it really shows that people coming in contact with legislators are potentially vulnerable to assault, harassment, or at least incredibly uncomfortable behavior, and also the power dynamics at play. You know, this young woman was here talking about an issue, a new sexual violence center in Bemidji, and a legislator had power over that issue. So there's some of the same dynamics at play that you saw in those other cases as well.
One of the things I pointed out to the rules changes that were being put into place was one thing I really liked was this idea that no, just because you're not in the House or this, you know, the House Rules Committee is in the Minnesota House on the Capitol grounds, that your job does indeed carry over into the rest of your life. So you can't, you know, this is not something where you can just separate behavior like this, that is something that carries over. And that's, as you were just talking about here, I mean, I think that's something that's needed in any kind of sexual harassment policy. I mean, and this is not specifically to the politicians. I think anytime you have a salesman who's constantly on the road doing sales calls or something of that nature, I mean, you do have to have a sexual harassment policy which encompasses the scope of the job that's being applied to.
Yeah, most employers do. And I think that was something they heard in the committee. They had the House formed a subcommittee on workplace safety. And that's something they heard, that policies are generally, for private employers, more robust than what the House policy does. It does include the fact that there might be people that your employees are working with that don't necessarily work for you, and how do you handle those situations as well. And the new policy does lay out, while the House can't necessarily compel third parties to come forward and testify or even give any information in terms of an investigation, they are saying in clear language in the policy now that they will investigate those incidents, both if a legislator is alleged to harassing someone who is a third party, or if a third party is alleged to have harassed, say, a legislator or someone else who works in the building. Those are now clearly outlined in the policy as something that they are going to investigate if they can, and to the best of their ability. And they also include incidents that happen outside of the Capitol complex. That was another thing I heard a lot about, mm-hmm. is that a lot of times these things don't just happen, you know, in the halls of the Capitol. There's conferences that legislators go to. There's meetings they have outside, you know, just outside of the Capitol. That's what this was as well. So now it does explicitly cover any incidents outside of the Capitol that still directly deal with legislative business.
Brianna Beersbach from InPost joining us. Let's bring up a big part of this. At least for me, there are some questions here. And that is, we've had Melissa Hortman, the minority leader, on a few times talking, and she has been very vocal that I do not know why this is taking so long. That is why on Friday, and you actually have the article on MinPost from last Friday about the Pepin-Housley bill, the Pepin in the House, Housley in the Senate, putting forward a change in verbiage, which basically would make it easier for women to file charges of sexual assault, sexual harassment, which is, I think, a good bill. And then you have these rules, which they were being – there were some heel dragging going on this. There wasn't moving ahead, and all of a sudden shazam, it was, you know, light speed. All of a sudden these rules are getting approved. This incident with Hamilton happened the weekend of the blizzard, so it was almost 2 weeks ago. And, you know, so I guess the question I have is, when did the Minnesota GOP, at least House leaders, do you have any idea when they became aware of this situation? Because it sure would make a lot of sense with their sudden urgency to deal with this issue after dragging their heels for so long that they were aware that there was another case coming down, another allegation coming down, and henceforth the visuals on this were going to look horrific. So that's what really pushed them to get this stuff done.
You know, I think it's unclear. You know, leaders weren't incredibly available yesterday, but I know in other reports I've read, it sounds like maybe Representative Hamilton knew there was a police report filed, but wasn't necessarily communicating that with leaders. So it's unclear how much they knew and before these other wheels were sort of already turning on the sexual harassment issue. It's possible it could have triggered a much quicker action on it. But you know, it's really unclear at this point. We don't know when Representative Hamilton heard about the reports, and we know that he was approached by reporters earlier this week, but we don't know when he alerted anyone on staff about that. And because he won't answer questions at this point, he's on the vice of counsel is not responding to any more questions. He just released a single statement about it. And leaders are being sort of quiet about it too. There's a lot of unknowns, I think, at this point.
And I'll admit the following statement is very speculative, but this is a woman, as you described, is an advocate on the Capitol. The chances that she could have, after that incident, gone and talked to someone else, whether that was Democratic leadership or Republican leadership, we don't know. But I mean, there was a behavioral change here by the Republicans in the House, where all of a sudden this issue seemed to get being pushed back, and then all of a sudden was, you know, there was really an effort to get this out, especially before Wednesday, before I think it was Kara Levin came out with the first story on Hamilton. And of course, the Star Tribune had their longer story yesterday. But I mean, it does seem there was a dramatic change of some sort. Have you, when you talk to I don't know who you talk to exactly, but when you talk to the Republican leaders about the bill that was going to change the verbiage, did you get any hint that there was anything more than that there was a motivation behind that? Or was it just something? I mean, it's a good bill. I'll be the first to say that bill's changing those changing those federal words to where it makes it easier for women to be able to charge on sexual assault, sexual harassment is a good thing. But I was wondering if you did you get any idea what the motivation directly behind the sponsors was?
I believe that actually came out of the workplace committee. There was a testifier who spoke to this a few weeks earlier on specifically the issue and the challenge that the language had made. And I'd spoken to that testifier separately after I'd kind of heard about the bill a little bit early, but okay. I had known for weeks that they had something in the works as well, just because I was following that issue. So I think that one did come directly out of the committee and testimony process.
The rules, though, did come through all of a sudden as they were getting stalled, it seemed. All of a sudden they got passed. There was some people, when you talk about the sexual harassment rules, Democrats wanted more citizens involved. The Republicans were against that. And then your own story does talk as well a little bit about, the public visuals. Will they be able to be – will there be the ability to see transparency in this committee? And it doesn't sound like there's going to be the transparency definitely some people do want. Where do you think this lies? Is this something that is evolving, or is this a hope that the Minnesota GOP in the House can just get this bill passed for the time being and be done with it for now?
Well, there was part of the rules, the changing to the House policy, a resolution to create an interim task force. So that is something that has already been passed and has to meet at least once before December. And they have some things that they're already scheduled to work on before that time, which is creating a phone and an email tip line about sexual harassment cases. If people don't know how to report or want to anonymously report, that's something they can do. They're also going to do a community survey similar to what the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission puts out on sort of the culture of the Capitol and issues and what can be improved. And they're also going to create a dedicated webpage on the policy and who can be reported to, and probably link to this new reporting portal as well. So those are some things that they're going to keep the conversation going on. You know, I don't know how much more they'll get into some of the issues that were left were not included in the policy, particularly the transparency issue, which there is really none in this new policy. It doesn't include any kind of public reporting or any point in the process where the public could get more information unless it rises to an ethics investigation or in the ethics committee, which is already the process now. So that could be part of the conversation. The legislature is always reluctant to make itself more publicly accountable and definitely reluctant to subject themselves to the Data Practices Act. So, I'm always hopeful that they will consider these things. They just ultimately never do. So that could be part of the discussion and potentially some other, you know, depending on how this Hamilton case goes, they might have some real examples on what might even need to already be improved in the House policy. Maybe the timing piece. I mean, that was something Democrats and Republicans had wanted. Representative Marianne O'Neill and John Lesch authored a proposal that required 30 days to look in and make some kind of, you know, determination, is there probable cause or not, and then move forward from there. That gave it actually some kind of a window where, as of now, there really was no timeline on these kind of investigations. So that could be part of the discussion as well.
All right. And by the way, one thing I should mention is Hamilton, who was the chair of the House Agricultural Finance Committee, I believe it was, he has been stripped of that chairmanship, correct?
He has. That's also what happened with Representative Cornish as well.
Right. Moving on to you and I, how many times have we talked about transparency at the Capitol? How about the other issue you and I have talked about? This has been the recurring theme for us for 4 years now. Last week, Minnesota Supreme Court declined to overturn a January ruling from the state appeals court that sex offender Kirk Fuchsleth no longer needed inpatient treatment for a sexual psychotic disorder and approved him for unconditional release. You and I have been talking about this for a while. Like I said, we have the courts now basically ordering the state to release people from the sexual offender treatment program, and the state legislature and the governor want nothing to do with that, even though they're being ordered directly by the courts to do so.
Yeah, it's a familiar situation. They were in it a few years ago, obviously, with a federal court judge ruling the program unconstitutional because it detained people indefinitely without really any signs of progress in terms of treatment and things like that, and rarely had ever let anyone out. This is a sort of different scenario, but still kind of the same result. The Court of Appeals really strictly and narrowly read a line of statute that said after people can be released after inpatient treatment, and that meant that this offender could be released immediately upon their reading of the statute. That is not how the state's been interpreting it, or other courts have. they've been interpreting it, that there is another step that can, that is often used, called provisional discharge. So you're not just immediately discharged without any guidance or any kind of supervision from your treatment. You can have a provisional discharge first, where you're in the community, maybe in a group home, but you're still wearing an ankle bracelet, or you're being monitored by someone and, until you're ready for full release. Mm-hmm. The state just wanted to clarify that that provisional discharge piece is still something they can use. So they acted very quickly this week. The Senate passed a bill unanimously, and I wonder, I assume the House will be doing something similar very soon.
It comes back to what you and I have talked about, is that if they want to make this a life sentence, they have to pass the laws in the Congress that basically outline the sentencing guidelines for these crimes. And it's a after the fact situation, and you know, no one is, you know, really necessarily wanting to have, you know, people who are, you know, susceptible to violate others released upon the public. But at the same time, there you are getting more and more of these cases, and as you've talked about, it's not just here, it's everywhere really, where, you know, you have these people who are given a 10-year, 15-year term, and it's turning into a 30, 40-year term with no chance of ever being able to be released into the public. And it does present an interesting case, because eventually this is all going to come undone, because you can't just retroactively keep sentencing people for a crime. You know, if you wanted to do that, you had to do it on the front end.
Absolutely. They're technically civilly committed to the program, and they're there as treatment, because a lot of the people in the program have already completed their prison sentence. This was created as a way to act as a step down before they're released into society if they're determined to still be potentially dangerous. And there are more than 700 people in the sex offender program of varying degrees, I think, of danger. Some very serious serial pedophiles and rapists who will probably never, ever be properly evaluated to be released from the program because they aren't safe to. Mm-hmm. But there are others in the program who kind of got wrapped into this whole wrap of it, who is particularly people with only juvenile offenses. Those are people who, when they're maybe 10 years old, had an offense, went into juvenile programs, and then on their 19th birthday were committed to MSOP and have been there ever since. And their recidivism rates are very low, but still they're kind of lumped into this big, very scary program in Minnesota, and rarely being let out. So I think that the court cases have really shook up the state in terms of saying we need to reevaluate all the people in the program, and letting some people go move into provisional discharge, you know, and not just keeping everyone here indefinitely, because it really did raise serious constitutional questions.
Well, and you've always said, I mean, there are definitively people that should never be released from these programs. They have really serious issues. But, you know, too, as well, you brought up the point is, like, we do actually have a lot of laws on the books about sex offenders within society, whether, you know, registering with police, you know, mm-hmm. you know, community notice, the where they can live in proximity to others. You know, there are already a lot of rules. It seems as if there's a reluctance. I mean, and I get it. There are some places where a person gets released and they immediately commit a crime, and that, you know, that really is bad. But there almost seems to be a hesitancy that when you have, as you described, some of these people who have, you know, the chance of returning to the crime is very low. There's a reluctance to even try out the societal monitoring that we do have in place outside of a correctional facility or program because of fear that it might not work.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the first 20 years of the program, no one was ever released. So no one had ever taken that first step to see how it would go. Mm-hmm. And especially when you look back at 2003, the murder of Drew Shodin, that was by a level 3 sex offender who's released from prison and not committed to the program. And a lot of people asked, you know, why wasn't he committed? He was obviously dangerous. And you noticed, I've looked into the data on this, commitment to the program spiked dramatically after that happened. You know, no one wanted to potentially let go the person who could do something as horrific as what happened to Drew. And I think that in that process, they probably caught some people who weren't getting caught before, and making sure they went through treatment, but they caught a whole lot of other people as well. And sort of the fear and the response to that crime that really captured the entire country's attention when it was going on.
I really think at some point you should write a book about this, because I think it's a little wonkish, but it is a fascinating story about how we as society second guess ourselves And once again, still to my knowledge, legislatures are not putting in the rules that and the penalties for crimes at the level they should be to make sure from this point forward they don't have that problem. And so this is going to be an issue that's going to confront us for decades to come.
Oh, absolutely. And another issue that's coming up is you mentioned we're putting a lot of laws up about where sex offenders can live. I mean, as more people are being released from these programs, the local communities are drawing big circles around themselves to say you can't live anywhere near anywhere in my community. That is putting a high concentration of sex offenders in certain neighborhoods, North Minneapolis, Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park. And they're saying, what if we drew circles around our community as well? So the more cities do this, there could potentially be a lawsuit as well, because the state runs into a situation where they can't put someone anywhere. There was actually a case where a sex offender, a black man, was put into a predominantly white community, and he was very easily targeted as this person, this new person. And it made it very hard for him to kind of go back into some kind of semblance of a normal life, because it was very easy to target in this small, close-knit community where he was the only black man living there. So that's something that I think it really makes it challenging in terms of trying to help people actually get back on their feet when you have so many parts of the state where they can't actually live. So that's going to be something that could potentially come to the courts as well. I think that's ripe for a lawsuit in the next year.
The one that always fascinates me is one that happened to me, where there was a sex offender that was released, and their family lived in the neighborhood nearby us, and they basically can't stop the person moving in with family. And so it's going to become interesting when you get one of those communities that has those big red circles around them. They can't stop that person moving into that red circle if there's a family member in there. And that would be my guess is where the next big lawsuit's going to be, is whether or not a community has a right to tell a family that's a homeowner whether or not a member of that family can stay in the family residence. You know, that's one that I think is going to come to a head at some point.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I think that would be, especially say they live near a daycare or school or some of these targeted areas where there's a lot of concern about that.
Brianna, I want to mention everyone. She's been on with us, I think it was four and a half years now, and you've been fantastic. You are leaving MinnPost. You've got a great new gig coming your way, correct?
Yeah, I'm heading to NPR on May 14th. I'm excited.
You are excited. When I heard that you were leaving for a job, I'm not joking when I said this, and Brett agrees with me here too. We both thought it was like, New York Times or something like that. You are that good of a journalist. I have you on not because of any bias. I have you on because you are one of the best journalists I've ever had the pleasure of chatting with, and I think you're just sensational. I know the likelihood we'll chat anytime soon is pretty unlikely, but I do hope that at some point in the future you and I can revisit again. I'd love that.
Absolutely, and thanks for having me on all these years. It's been great to chat with you.
It's been my pleasure, absolutely my pleasure. Spotlight this one, Brianna Bierschbach from MinnPost, kind enough to join us today. We'll link all of her stories online as well a little bit later on. Thanks, Brianna. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.